You're listening to the Write Project podcast and radio program, a show about writing and modern Newfoundland author culture. This program is produced and recorded at CHMR FM 93.5 FM in St. John's, Newfoundland and Labrador, and is aired on other great stations in the province and elsewhere in the country. It can also be heard online at www.chmr.ca. I'm your host, Matthew LeDrew.
Okay, we've got a cool one for you today. Today is an episode all about the NLBAs, which for those of you who don't know, are the Newfoundland and Labrador Book Awards put on by WANL, otherwise known as the Writers' Alliance of Newfoundland and Labrador. There are six total shortlisted in 2018 in two different categories. In general fiction, we have Bridget Canning for the greatest hits of Wanda Janes from Breakwater Books. We have Joel Thomas Hines from Will All Be Burnt in Our Bed Some Night from HarperCollins, and we have Mary Walsh from Crying for the Moon, also from HarperCollins. In children's and young adult, we have Lori Duty for The Puffin Problem, produced by Running the Goat. We have Sheila Lukens for Full Speed Ahead, Errol's Bell Island Adventure from Breakwater Books, and we have Rebecca North, author of Elliot and the Impossible Fish, also from Breakwater Books. On this episode, we are joined by five of the six that were shortlisted for the Newfoundland and Labrador Book Awards. We have Bridget Canning, Mary Walsh, Lori Duty, Sheila Lukens, and Rebecca North. We also have one of the jury members for the fiction category, me, Matthew LeDrew, of the Write Project podcast, which was an honor that I can finally tell people that I took part in over the summer. Had to read nearly 50 books. That was interesting. It also made for some very interesting interviews, as all of these people are wondering if they've won, and I can't tell them. So that's awkward, but lots of fun. Okay, without further ado, we have Lori Duty, author of The Puffin Problem, as well as there was a precursor book, Capelin Weather, is that correct?
Yes, they came out the same month, essentially, last year.
Oh, really? Okay, that's impressive. The Puffin Problem is said to pose a delightfully silly and improbable question. What would happen if St. John's, Newfoundland was overrun by a parliament of puffins?
That's right.
Which is sounds lovely. It sounds like they would actually get more done than Parliament currently does. Okay, your book has actually been shortlisted.
Yeah.
Can I get your reaction to that fact?
I'm pretty excited. Like we were saying, I just came out last year. I just started publishing last year, so it's a huge compliment and encouragement that I'm on the right track.
Yes, you're with Running the Goat, and they're an amazing publisher. They produce these beautiful little volumes. I had a chance to speak with them at a publisher's panel recently. They produce these gorgeous, almost crafted volumes. They're more about the artistry of producing the book.
Definitely. There's a really high standard for both the writing and the illustration, the book design, the whole package.
Yeah, they think about every part of the process, which is genius.
Yes.
Have you gotten a chance to read any of the other people that were shortlisted yet?
I have not.
That's
I've been busy working on other books.
Yeah, no, that's perfectly fine. That's normal, actually. I write too. We're busy people. Yeah. Okay, can you tell me a little bit about the book? What drew you to it? Where the idea came from?
Sure. I was trying to come up with an idea of a book about puffins, and nothing was really working out. I just thought they'd be really cute, and I knew that my kids thought puffins were cute. So then I kept thinking of the Alfred Hitchcock movie, The Birds, and maybe I could kind of work that in so that St. John's becomes overrun with puffins.
Okay. That's a hilarious genesis for a children's book to think of, like, a very famous horror novel.
Yeah, and there's even one drawing in the book that's taken from the movie with a playground set covered in puffins, but in the movie it's, I think, ravens or crows.
Oh, funny. Yeah. Awesome. And actually, funnily enough, currently on Amazon.ca, your book's pretty high up in the children's books about birds category. You're at you're at number 24 in all of Canada for that.
Oh, that's exciting to know.
Yeah. I happen to be on there right now reading, so I know what I'm talking about. That's great. Okay, well, now we have Bridget Canning. So you and your novel, The Greatest Hits of Wanda Janes, were nominated this year, along with We'll All Be Burnt in Our Bed Some Night and Crying for the Moon. Have you gotten a chance to read any of the other finalists? And what'd you think of them?
I've read Joel's book. I haven't read Mary's yet.
Yeah, it's good. Mary's book was quite good, actually. It was interesting. But anyway,
yeah, we were both Mary Walsh and I were both up for like best first book award with the Atlantic Book Awards, and that was, I was just trying not to fangirl out the whole time. You know? Joel's book is, I mean, amazing. I mean, I think I've read most of his work, and this one just, okay. This is a compliment. But if I'm reading something and it actually gives me a physical reaction, look, I thought I was going to be sick a couple of times reading Joel's book, so that means it's good writing. If something can actually, you know, move me physically, you know that he's done, that the author has done a fantastic job. And the voice and the way he balanced, you know, Johnny kind of the point of view switching, where Johnny is talking about what kind of what's going on in the present and always talking to himself. And the way he managed the colloquialisms that kind of grounded in, you know, the place in Newfoundland, in St. John's. Not St. John's, sorry, he's from around the bay, isn't he? Putting it in Newfoundland that way was just so skillful and mind-blowing, really. I really love that book.
I enjoyed it, too. It reminded me of, it was the structure of the Odyssey and the cadence, like, the style of, like, Huck Finn, in that way, like, not in the, like, in the same way that Quine decided to write Huck Finn from the cadence and in the voice of a young boy from the Deep South.
Yes.
He chose to emulate the voice of someone from St. John's, Newfoundland, which is interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
Spectacular book, yeah.
How are you feeling, Bridget?
Great. Overwhelmed, honestly. I mean, overwhelmed in a good way. Like, it's, I didn't expect, you know, there to be this much response to it. So, it's, and you know, to be up against Mary Walsh and Joel Thomas Hines' work is really, really flattering.
It's a bit of an interesting year, your three names up against each other. We have Sheila Lukens, author of Errol's Bell Island Adventure. Okay, we are on the line with Sheila Roberts Lukens, who is the author of Full Speed Ahead, Errol's Bell Island Adventure. How are you today, Sheila?
I'm very good, thank you.
Okay, Sheila has been nominated in the Children/YA category for a Newfoundland and Labrador Book Award. How do you feel about that?
Oh, I'm thrilled. It was very, very nice for them to do that. I'm very pleased with it.
So tell us a bit about the book that's been nominated, if you don't mind.
Okay. It's about a little mouse who lives in a fictional lane in Beachy Cove, and he decides to have an adventure one day and hitch a ride with a car to the Belle Island Ferry. He ends up going over to Belle Island and goes down in the mines and explores the history of the Belle Island mines, and then returns home, and of course has various adventures along the way.
That sounds great. I've seen that one in bookshelves. I'll be honest, I have not read it yet. I read all the adult oriented NLBA things, but I haven't seen a lot of the children stuff, so I'll look forward to reading that. Actually, I've got some godchildren who I think would like that. I'll definitely pick it up.
Okay.
Have you actually read any of the other NLBA books, either children's or adults, anything like that?
Yes, I've read Joel Hines' book. I haven't read the other two yet. I own them, but I haven't read them. I've got a huge stack of books to get through. I've read Elliot and the Impossible Fish. I haven't read the Puffin one yet.
Interesting. Okay, cool. What do you think of Joel's book?
I really liked it. I thought it was really well written.
Okay, great, good stuff. Thank you very much. We have Rebecca North, author of Elliot and the Impossible Fish.
Yes, currently I have two picture books out, A Picnic at the Lighthouse, which was illustrated by Nancy Keating, and Elliot and the Impossible Fish, which was illustrated by Laurel Keating.
Yeah, I actually liked the, I read the Picnic at the Lighthouse book. I didn't realize that was by you until I just started this interview and looked up your past work, but I know that book. I read that book to my godchildren, actually.
Oh, awesome.
It's wonderful.
Yeah, you probably recognize the fairyland lighthouse in that book. Yes. All the illustrations are of the lighthouse in Fairyland. So.
Yes, absolutely. Love it. So can I get your reaction? How does it feel to be nominated for a Newfoundland Labrador Book Award?
Amazing. I was so excited. Yeah, I was just... I was thrilled. I got a call. I was in my car. I have two small children. They were both screaming at the time. I didn't pick up the phone because I was driving the car. But when I got back, I saw that Breakwater Books had called, and I wondered what that was about. So I had set my kids down, still screaming on the lawn. And I looked at my email and I saw that I had an email from Breakwater Books, and they told me I had been nominated for this award, and I was just so happy. I was so excited. I was doing a jump for joy. I think anybody walking by must have thought I was pretty crazy because I was there jumping around while my kids were upset, but that it was wonderful. It was a great moment. I was really, really happy.
I'm glad. Yeah, no, it really should be. It's a wonderful book. Can you tell me what Elliot and the, for anyone who doesn't know in the audience, what is Elliot and the Impossible Fish about? I'm going to assume it's about a young boy named Elliot and an impossible fish, but maybe there's deeper meanings here.
That's a pretty good assumption.
Okay.
So it is a story of adventure on the high seas.
Okay.
There is a boy named Elliot, and he dreams of catching the biggest fish that anybody has ever seen. That's his dream. And so one night he makes a wish on a star, and the next morning he finds himself on the ocean in a boat with the chance to catch the big one. And on his journey, he meets different animals along the way that try to teach him to fish like they do. So he meets a humpback whale that tries to teach him to open his mouth really wide to catch the fish, and a seal that tries to teach him to use his flippers, which he doesn't have, to dive deep down to catch the fish. And even all these animals seem to find him lacking in some way or another, but even when things seem impossible, Elliot does not give up. He keeps going.
That sounds wonderful, actually. That sounds like a lot of fun. I'm going to pick up that one for my godkids, too. That sounds wonderful, the whole trying different things and learning from different animals and how they catch the fish. And also it's starting it as a dream. I don't know if this was, but it had this, my favorite book growing up was Where the Wild Things Are. And it just like starting out with this wish and then going into a alternate world, let's say, like in your imagination or in a dream. That's harkens back to a lot of cool children's stories from when I was young.
Yeah, it's kind of a cool theme. And what I really like about Elliot and the Impossible Fish is it ends on a bit of a twist. So I guess this is a bit of a spoiler alert for anybody listening.
Mm-hmm.
But the final page is just an illustration, and it's not quite clear whether this was all a dream or whether it really happened. So that's kind of it's up for the reader to decide, and children get pretty excited about that. I've been to many classrooms with this book now, actually, and it's really cool to see the literary debate that can be sparked with this book from a young age, because the kids ask me, they say, you know, what happened? Was it a dream, or did it really happen? And I say, I've left it up to you to decide. I do have an idea in my head what I think happened, but it's really up to you. And then things get going. Like, there's often two camps that will form. There's one camp that'll say it was a dream, and it had to be a dream because, you know, animals, they can't talk. And then there's another camp that says, well, you know, he wished upon a star, so anything's possible. It really did happen, you know. So it's just really cool to see. So
this sounds like the Life of Pi of children's fiction, like where you just end up debating what was real and what was not. Animals can't talk, animals can't do this, like.
Yeah, that's actually a really good comparison for this book. I hadn't thought of that, being on a boat with kind of an animal. It's similar.
Yeah. Anyway, sounds wonderful. I'm actually going to go check it out. This is not one that I had checked out previous to speaking with you, the author, but that sounds lovely. I am going to actually check that out. That
oh, awesome. Like a lot of fun.
That's great. Okay, well, now we have Mary Walsh, author of Crying for the Moon.
Hey, Matthew, how are you?
I'm doing wonderful.
Mary's on with us because her book Crying for the Moon, which was a thriller that came out last year?
Yeah, I think last March, maybe.
Yeah, 2007 it was, yeah.
The March before, yeah.
Crying for the Moon was just shortlisted for the Newfoundland and Labrador Book Awards alongside Joel Thomas Hines and Bridget Canning.
Yep.
I've read the book. I absolutely adored every part of it. I love the character of Maureen and everything that she goes through. Well, I don't love everything she goes through, but I love the way that it's... Yeah, I love the
That's
way that it's told.
You know, I'm really happy to hear that because, I mean, a lot of women have said that to me, older women and young women and stuff like that. And I haven't heard that from a lot of men, whether young men or old men, you know what I mean? And yeah. I felt like, I think I wrote a book that only women understand because they understand Maureen. But I'm really happy to hear that because I just think she's a human being.
Yeah.
And And she, you know, she just makes all those mistakes and sometimes that gets on people's nerves, right? That she isn't better.
I don't perceive, when I read it, I didn't perceive it as her mistakes, per se. Like, there is, for instance, it can be hard when writing any character if bad things continue to happen to them. There is a problem. At some point, it's like you want, even though it's realistic, you almost want the character to be better. You know what I mean? You want them to rise above.
Yes.
But I think when I read it, it was like this window into, this is actually the experience of an entire large, like 50% of our population, is that you just have to put up with the fact that there are very bad men out there and the world is full of not great human beings.
Yeah. And over and over again, you get the message that you are powerless anyway. And so in order to just, you know, stick your courage to the screwing post and do something takes maybe more courage than like the treasure of somebody who was going through it. I'm not, you know what I mean? Because
I do.
Men are expected, they are encouraged, they are, every book is about them, you know, grabbing hold of the sticking post and, you know, going forward and doing the brave thing, right? There's very few books, is there, about men who don't, you know, who don't make the change. Like, and I found with men actually in life, like men, like...
No, go ahead.
If I break up with someone, I mean, this is a long time ago now, so it's all right for me to talk about it. Like, I would often call them up when I got drunk and, you know, like, I found it really hard to move on, right? Like, I was... but I found that men would just, even if they loved you or something and they decide to break up with you, it'd be over. That was mostly with men. I mean, all men are different, obviously.
Yeah.
But there was that thing where you cut it off and it's over and that's done and that door's closed and it won't be opening again. You know what I mean?
I gotta say, that sounds true. I hate that it sounds true, but it sounds true.
Yeah.
Just my very limited experience, I'm thinking
that. And that other opportunities are waiting for them. And, you know, I don't know. I think it's, men are given a whole different message than women. And so poor old Maureen, you know, it took an enormous amount of courage for her to just keep going because she really thought that she was worthless and broken and everything about her was no good. And you know what I mean? So,
I do.
Yeah.
I adored this book. Can I talk about it a bit? If it's not too spoilery, it's right at the beginning. I wanted to ask something. I'm obviously not a writer on your skill level or experience level, but I write a little bit, and when I do, I'm very much a structuralist. Like, I tend to go by the set structure, and then I experiment a little bit within the rules of that. There's a cool thing, or maybe I just haven't had enough experience to learn when to experiment, but there was a cool moment early on. You did, the prologue of the book is a flash forward showing, and this is not spoilers because it's the prologue, so... But it shows Maureen possibly killing her husband, at the very least poisoning her very abusive husband and turning away and leaving.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you something, and if there's no real answer to this, if it's just that's what I decide to do, I will accept that because it's a wonderful book, so whatever you chose to do is fine.
Yeah.
But usually when there's a flash forward to something thrilling, if not action-packed, like the poisoning of one's husband, then that flash forward usually is to, like, the end of the third act. You flash forward to, like, four chapters in, and then backtrack to some of Maureen's past, which I love those chapters in Montreal. Those are heartbreaking. But I wanted to ask why the flash forwards there like that. Like, it was such an interesting, it made me turn my head and got me very interested because it's a thriller and I love thrillers, but it also played with that convention. And I wanted to know if that was, as soon as I read it, I wanted to get you on and ask you if that was intentional.
Matthew, that's really interesting because I'm not much of a structuralist and that's where I've always been weak. Really, in all my writing, like in except the structure of a sketch, I guess I'm pretty good on. I whatever reason, I suppose I've been doing it now for so long. But you know, structure is so important in screenplays. Like it's so rigid. It's like writing a sonnet. You know, it's so rigid. I felt the novel, even though I know there is a recognized structure to thrillers and all that, but I felt so free when I wrote the novel. And really, who inspired me was like Dickens, and I know it's a different time and people don't have time for that, but like he would, like in Great Expectations, Pip would go off with the guy, the clerk from the lawyer's clerk, and they'd go down to his father's, the place he'd built for his father, and they spend a lot of time down there talking to the father about nothing, you know, that had anything to do with what was coming. And I mean, I'm not saying that I did that because I don't think, because Dickens was, of course, writing in a daily newspaper and was being paid by the word, so
yeah,
he, you know, it was to his advantage. But the freedom that you feel sometimes when you read a Dickens novel, and everyone doesn't feel this way when they read Dickens. Some people feel, oh, I can't believe that we're going there now.
I agree with you, actually.
I feel that sense of freedom, and so in a way, that's the way I wrote the book too. You know what I mean? I didn't embrace anybody's structure. I just tried to tell the story in the best way that I could, and I really wanted to be more experimental, but then I realized that it was really getting in the way of, you know, there's a guy, oh my god, he wrote about the Yorkshire murders, and it was like reading James Joyce and Ian Rankin, like some mix between James Joyce and Ian Rankin, and you never really knew. Like, the thriller was so thrilling, you never really knew what was going on. Like, apparently in the Yorkshire, you know, the Yorkshire killer guy, the police, who were so corrupt, that they murdered some people in Yorkshire during the Yorkshire Ripper time.
Wow.
And to make it look like the Ripper, right?
That's intense. And this is all documented.
But this is a novel, so it's like, you don't know where you are half the time, but it's so exciting. I forget the name. He wrote a trilogy called Read Something or Other, and it was all about the Yorkshire Ripper, but it was so exciting. I really wanted to do something like that, but I realized I didn't have the skill sets, you know, for it, really, because it was confusing me after a while with myself, whereas I didn't mind being confused by this guy, like, that, you know, some of the, like, I didn't know whether it was the Yorkshire Ripper who was killing people, or whether it was the cops who was doing it, or what was going on, but it was so well done that you were with it 100%, right?
That's actually my favorite part. I read a lot of thrillers. I that's the genre I attempt to write in. I'm going to say attempt because, you know. But it's yours is, I think, is one of the best ones I've read in, I'd say, 10 years. And part of it is because it doesn't follow that structure. Like so much of thrillers are so structured.
Yes.
That, like, it's so, I mean, you'll know this from writing in screenplay and television. The whole setup, remind, payoff. Setup, remind, payoff. That pattern.
I know. If and it gets tiresome after a while.
I know, but with thrillers, you've read so many that, like, when you see the setup and then you see the remind, you can guess the payoff, and you don't even need to read the rest of the book.
Right.
Yep.
Well, because here's another thing that, you know, I started out the book as a kind of coming-of-age thing. And, you know that woman, Roz Chast, she's a cartoonist. She does a lot of cartoons, and they're different panels. You know, she'll have six or eight panels in one cartoon. But anyway, she did this thing. You know, the growth of a reader or a reader's life or something. And it was in the New Yorker maybe 4 or 5 years ago. And so there's, you know, Roz Chass as a little girl reading, you know, Trixie Belden and Nancy Drew, and then there she is reading, you know, Doris Lessing, and there she is reading, you know, Dostoevsky, and there she is at around 50, starting to read mystery books again. Like, you know, she starts off, and it's all a big return, you know, like at 50, she's reading mystery books, but she's not admitting it. At 60, she's just out and out reading, you know, Scandinavian noir and Ian Rankin and stuff. And sort of it happened to me too, in just exactly that way. Like, I started off with Trixie Belden and Nancy Drew and all those, and the Hardy Boys and all those guys, and Ginny Gordon and, oh my God, Cherry Ames and all those books. And then really was not interested in penny dreadfuls and mysteries and thrillers and stuff. Really not interested at all.
Yeah.
For many years, and felt quite contemptuous of them. You know what I mean?
I do.
And then found my way back to them, and now, you know, spend a good bit of my reading time reading them.
Yeah.
And so after I got through some of the book, I realized that I wanted to tell, you know, I wanted that to be in there. I wanted some aspect of a thriller to be in there, some aspect of what I was actually interested in at that point to be in there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I always look at it as like the typical hardcore lit novel that might get put up for awards or stuff like that. They have something to say, and that's great. This novel and many others, and more thrillers than I think people give credit for, something happens and they have something to say. Like, just because there's cool stuff happening doesn't mean it can't also have something cool to say.
Exactly. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. So I'm so thrilled that you like the book. That gives me so much pleasure. I'm thrilled also to be shortlisted, you know, with Joel and Bridget. So, you know.
That actually lets me to the question I'm asking everyone. Have you had a chance to read any of the other novels, be it ones that you're shortlisted with or from other categories or whatever?
I've read both Bridget's and Joel's, and find them both amazing books. I think Joel really, I mean, I've read all Joel's work, you know, he's a good friend of mine.
Yeah.
I think this was a step outside of what he was doing with Down to the Dirt and Right Away Monday and those other books. And he kind of went somewhere else with this. And I found that really interesting and really good. And Joel considers it to be a funny book. I don't consider it to be a funny book at all. And neither does his father. I said to Joel's father, and Joel's father said, yeah, you know, because, you know, right off the bat, there's only one ending for that young fellow, right?
Yeah.
And so it's not like, you know, right off the bat, and it's like, oh, well, I don't have to read the book, because you do. But it's just like that rising sense of dread you have all the time, and it's so well done in that way, and you know. And he's fine, you know, he's so lacking in hope, and yet he's ever hopeful that he will do this thing, you know, and it's just really brilliantly done, I think. And Bridget's book, this is the first book I read by her, and it's wonderful. And she's just put out another book about things that are written on the ladies' room wall.
I've picked that one up.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to getting that too. Yeah,
It's amazing. You should read it. It's amazing. I was actually talking to her about that, but it's just a photo book of graffiti written in ladies' rooms, ladies and gender-neutral rooms, and sometimes there's accompanying fiction along with it. There's only about 6 short stories in it, varying in page length and stuff like that, but the main draw is just these odd things that were written, things that are written in the ladies' room.
You know, it's interesting. We started Kodko in 1973 in Toronto. We swore over to the Imperial Room, and we were writing, and in the ladies' room of the Imperial Room, that it read, "The wild cod lie dead in the ocean, the wild cod lie dead in the sea," and that was it. And I said, oh my God. And at that time, the idea of it being wild cod seemed really ridiculous, and that they would be dead seemed totally ludicrous. But we wrote a song called "The Wild Cod Lie Dead in the Sea," all caused by, oh my God, dead in the sea. They all died of water pollution caused by the oil industry. Yeah. And then we had this big, you know, thing. But yeah, it's like interesting. Hey, the stuff you pick up on the bathroom wall, I mean, it was so prophetic. And when we wrote it, it seemed ridiculous that we would ever get to that place of 1992. It seemed beyond imagining that we could come to a place like that where the wild cod did lie dead in the ocean.
Which now it's quaint that we ever thought it wouldn't happen.
Yeah.
Time is not kind to our expectations.
Well, I am so thrilled that you like the book. That is the biggest thing that happened. That's the best thing that happened
I can't stop recommending it to people, honestly. Oh, like, I've given it to my sister now, and she's an avid thriller reader, and she's going through it, and it's gonna... That one copy I got is gonna make its rounds, but I'm also just selling everyone I can on it, because I think it's a wonderful, wonderful book.
Oh, great. Thank you, Matthew.
No problem.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on again. For all of you, we'll be here again next week at 4:30 Newfoundland time or online at chmr.ca. Please tune in and we'll talk more about writing culture in Newfoundland.